Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.
Hello and welcome to the web show on the British Tech Network. I'm John Hume, and for this show we've assembled a great panel to discuss all things accessibility. So, first of all, I need to introduce you all to Mr. Paul Wheatley. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm not too bad, thank you, John. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad, not so bad. Do you want to introduce us to your guests that you have with us today?
Yeah, sure. We'll start off on the left side of the country, and appearing from Glasgow for his first time on this podcast is Craig. How are you doing, mate?
I'm good, Paul. How are you? Hi, everyone.
I'm not too bad, not too bad. You had a good weekend? Good long weekend?
Yeah, not bad. Just staying before, the weather. We've done our best with it.
Yeah, it was actually quite nice down here this morning. We had the sun. And in fact, it was really nice down here yesterday morning, to the point that we were in Edinburgh yesterday morning and texted a few friends saying, yeah, come over to our house for a barbecue tonight. And we got a bunch of texts going, really? Have you seen the weather?
Yeah, as it's raining at the moment in Glasgow, but it was the sun was shining this afternoon, so.
Yeah, very good. Do you want to, just to explain a little bit about what you do and what, where you do it?
Yeah, sure. I've been in front-end development for about 10 years. My exposure to accessibility has come through web standards and semantic building. I'm currently full-time in financial services, and I also do a bit of consultancy and freelance work.
Cool. And moving swiftly across the country to Edinburgh. I'm assuming you're in Edinburgh tonight, Ian, is that right?
I am indeed, yes.
Yes, is Ian Mackay, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good, yeah. Today's been a full-on day, but getting through it.
Grand. Did you get any time to stand and sit down and watch The Queen?
No, I didn't watch The Queen. I did listen to last week's show, though.
Oh, well, oh, that's nice. is it safe to ask if you enjoyed it or not, or do we want to leave that?
Yeah, no, it was great. Really interesting.
It's a bit of a gamble, that one. But
and I think there might be some crossover between the stuff you were talking about last week and this week's topic, actually, but we'll see.
Probably will be. Cool. And also with us is Sarah. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm feeling very much outnumbered by the Scots on the show tonight.
Yeah, help me.
We should have done this last week when I was in Ireland, and it would have actually been at least, I would have been at least from another country. And then we would have had the bases covered, possibly.
Yeah, well, I mean, we do have kind of West Coast Scots, which, you know, they're almost a different breed, so.
Really?
Listeners, please don't hold it against them, listeners. They're still humans too.
Well, actually, interestingly,
allegedly.
I was looking at the web stats this afternoon, and America has a huge amount of the proportion of listeners to the British Tech Network generally is from America. I was quite surprised about that. I kind of thought, being British Tech, I thought a huge proportion of them would be from the UK, but I was quite interested in that. So they quite like the Scots, is what I'm trying to go here for here.
Maybe they tuned in looking for the Queen. They must have been bitterly disappointed.
I was going to say, I mean, being sensible about it for a sec, I think there are very good reasons why that is. And I think that's generally that without being affecting us over here, having a go at us over here, I think the Americans get podcasting a lot more than we do.
I think so. Cool. So, John, what's our topic for tonight?
So tonight we will be discussing all things accessibility. So we want to have a chat about what accessibility actually is, why it's important, who's affected by the legislation, what the legislation is, the secondary benefits of accessibility. So what comes along with, if you place accessible content on your site, what other benefits do you get for doing that? And also the varying different levels of accessibility. So should we start by talking a bit about what accessibility actually is?
Craig, do you want to kind of give us a bit of a brief from your point of view about what accessibility actually is?
Yeah, sure. Focuses on the content. It's basically making the content usable and readable to people with all abilities and disabilities. It should be considered from the outset, from the start, and everything you do and everything you build. That way you're going to save on costs in the long run. It's basically about making your content readable and structuring it in a semantic way. Not just visually, on the screen for browsers, but also for a set of technologies, which I think we'll get into later on.
There seems to be a bit of a debate around whether it actually harms innovation, having to kind of look and make sure that things are all kind of backwards compatible and things like that. Do you think that's an issue?
The thing about web accessibility for me is I often come in to projects at the end to do audits and to verify other developers' work. The frustrating thing for me is it's very easy to make everything accessible from the start, but because we've got such varying standards in front end in this country, and over the world actually, it's very hard to, I don't know, there's a lot of frustration. It can be done easy from the start, but because there's a low standard of development in this country, it can harm innovation, because a lot of people can't get the basics right.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it, though, is actually about having alternative ways of displaying stuff. So it doesn't necessarily have to stop you from doing the latest whiz-bang stuff, but it's about having a way of saying you can change the way the site's displayed in the same way that we do with mobile, in such that with the detection, we use a detection mechanism to recognise it and display it using different style sheets. I think with the web, it's about giving the options somewhere on the page, normally on the very top of the page, of a way of changing it into different formats.
I think so long as you build, so long as you make your site if you're building it semantically and make it flexible enough, then it should be able to be changed by any device. And so long as you follow good techniques like progressive enhancement, then that will save you a lot of hassle in the long run.
Yeah, I think it's about building something that's relatively simple structurally, but kind of having an awareness of the different contexts that people will be approaching that site from. Because obviously, a lot of accessibility is about making it available to people who are not necessarily using standard devices, standard software, and having an awareness of what those other tools are, how they view the page. It's no different, as Sarah said, to mobile design in many ways, because you're just sort of taking a different context and trying to apply that to the content you've produced.
Yeah. John, are you still here? I'm just very aware that I've
no,
heard
I'm
from
still,
you. All right, sorry, I was worried you'd maybe cut out there.
No, I was listening, fascinated. I was going to say, we should really start to talk a little bit about when we talk about stuff like the semantic web or progressive enhancement. I'm worried that maybe we should, you know, define that a little bit more in the context of what we're talking about. So is it Craig, when you mentioned talking about building things in a semantic way, do you want to break that down for us a little bit and talk about that for a sec?
Yeah, sure. So you got your HTML, which is where your content sits. There's many ways you can put that on a page so it displays in a browser, but by structuring that content in a semantic way, what we mean is there's certain HTML tags that have meaning behind them. So heading levels, tables, forms, the way that the words are marked up, and emphasis and all that sort of stuff's defined in there. So you can build a website and it looks okay in a browser, but the underlying HTML may not have much meaning to it, or you can build it with HTML tags that have more meaning, and that'll help you in the long run. That helps other devices understand that information a bit better. It's basically structuring your information.
The way I had it explained to me, which has always stuck with me, and I know it's a very simple way of thinking of it, is that if you turn off all the styles and just look at the order that things are in, the most important stuff will be at the top, and everything will make sense, the order that everything is placed within the page, rather than necessarily just throwing things in a way that makes sense immediately to the browser. You're able to just look at the raw information that's there and make sure that makes sense standing on its own.
Yeah, and, that's always a good test.
Yeah, that's kind of stuck with me as a real baseline standard to work from there.
Mm. Yeah, and that's where progressive enhancement comes from as well. Your website essentially should be able to work just looking at the HTML. Then you bring its style with CSS, and then if you want to enhance it further with JavaScript and all your sort of swooshy, cool things, then that's the way they're layered on, yeah.
I think but as well, sorry, Sarah, carry on.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the things, I was relatively late coming to accessibility. It wasn't really until I worked for a local authority that I really had an introduction to it. And then I was a complete convert to it. And coming from a point of view of being a web designer beforehand, where it was basically, okay, well, you just create the HTML, you create the style sheets, and, you know, it just works. You know, if it looks great in a browser, in various browsers, then that's it, job done. This fundamentally changes the way that you actually structure, especially when you're designing templates or master pages for a site, because, as has been said, you actually make sure that the content is actually rendered in the correct order so that it will display without any style sheet usage at all.
And I think one thing that needs to be remembered as well, and I think a lot of people just associate accessibility with blind people. And it's not just about blind people. It's about a number of different disabilities. But the biggest thing that needs to be remembered is that the largest blind user is Google. And Google needs all this kind of semantic markup, and it needs your page to be laid out in all hierarchical, I always find that a funny word to say, hierarchical way, you know, just to help SEO. So, I mean, it's not just something you have to worry about if you're, you know, if you want to get, you know, if you want to make use of people with disabilities or have them as your customers and things like that.
I think it's also, it's not just about text. You've also got to think about audio and video on a page. If you've got video on a page, then really you should be creating a transcript of anything that you actually publish. The same with audio as well. It's really thinking about all the content on the site, not just the text.
Even down to the level of making the player accessible as well. So absolutely. You should be able to use keyboard controls to actually, you know, use the embedded player. So if you're going to embed YouTube or if you're going to embed Vimeo, there are other tactics that you can use in order to make them more accessible and more friendly. And there's various third-party open source layers that you can apply over the top that actually provide much better keyboard navigation than what they provide out of the box.
Yeah, I think transcripts are one of the biggest problems when it comes to that kind of video stuff, because it's such a, you know, it's practically one person's job, if not a number of people, a team in an organization's job, to sit and put transcripts together for all the videos on the website. And I think somebody who eventually kind of takes Siri or Nuance technology or something like that and manages to make a website that you just basically upload an MP4 file into and it drops out a text file at the other end. You know, that's going to be a killer app for these kind of things in the future.
It's there already, Paul. You know that last week we were, I don't want to plug anyone too much, we were at a session with the guys from Autonomy who run the Idle search engine. One of the points, one of the things they showed us with it was the BBC News site running in real time and the transcripts appearing underneath. They were using it to harness the words and then show related articles on the left side. But that transcript could be taken at the end and, you know, cleaned up a little bit. You still got the job for the content editor, but the technology seems to be there. It's just how widespread it is.
Yeah, I used to work about 4 years ago or something for a company that made kind of search for plugging in your website. And that was one of the big things that they were working on when I left, was finding a way to actually index video content. So actually, but at the time they were, you know, still kind of scratching their heads as to how to do it. But apparently Google was dealing with that, and so they were actually able to search the content within YouTube videos and things like that. But I've never heard anything more about that project.
It's certainly something that I think needs to be addressed in a bit more in depth. I think one of the issues that we have is this a bit of almost apathy from organisations towards approaching accessibility and doing what Craig was saying about baking it in from the word go. Mm-hmm. I think you're always going to make it a lot easier for yourself if you include your accessible approach right from the start. Yes. And without doing that, you're making more work for yourself. You're making it more difficult for users and for Google to get to your content. And also, you're just causing problems. You can cause yourself problems from a legislative point of view as well, if they do ever decide to start enforcing the standards that are there in any greater strength.
Yeah, I think a lot of people kind of see technology as this magic bullet that kind of fixes the problem for you. So, oh, I'll just create my content and then some technological solution will come along and it'll transcribe it for me and I'll add markers to this video and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it's no substitute for, as you say, you know, getting in there as you're building the content and working out how it should work for people. Because no matter how good the technology gets, you know, no matter how much it can do for us, it's no substitute for a pair of human eyes and a human brain on it.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of the reason why I mentioned about master doing this correctly in master pages and templates, because it's not something you should be thinking about at a content level. I've been working with content management systems that try to enforce different levels of functionality to make it happen, because it's also when you're working in an organization where you've got a lot of pages and you're using a CMS and you've got a widespread user base in terms of web authors, it doesn't just come down to the actual design of the website. It's also about what you put, how you display the actual physical content for an individual page. The individual web authors have a responsibility to make sure that content, and that's really hard. Especially for a CMS to try and actually enforce something that will make it a page conform to a site that is completely accessible.
Yeah, you should be able to completely separate your content from your templating systems and indeed everything else that comes on top of that. Definitely, I thought you make a really good point earlier, Sarah, about before your knowledge of accessibility, the way that you used to build. On a daily basis, I find myself working with third-party suppliers who I essentially have to educate through the entire project life cycle, because there's so many developers out there who don't have an appreciation of accessibility. Their companies would have signed on to supply a deliverable to WCAG to AA or whatever, and maybe they've got a project in the portfolio that's met this, and so they can demonstrate it. Yet when I come to work with the developers, often it's a big education piece, and it's exhausting. You know, having to talk these developers how to mark up a table or why they should have labels on the form inputs and all that sort of stuff. It's very, very frustrating. I don't know how we fix that other than from a business level. I often take that back to the business and explain to them the frustrations that we're having and why the project's running so long. But I think in general that we have to do something about the level of understanding for the developers.
I think if you've got a commercial site, I mean, I must admit, I haven't, other than the work that I do outside of my normal day job, I haven't done anything for a commercial site. My only experience of accessibility is really in the public sector. But I would imagine that the best way to get through is to say to the business that if you don't handle this, you're restricting the people and therefore the audience that can view your site. And you're setting up shopping carts and things like that. You want to maximise the people that are able to buy stuff on your site.
Oh, of course, yeah. I take all these. I take the moral obligation, the legal risks, the whole lot. Take that back to the business. That's all cool. It's just face to face dealing with these suppliers and having to explain this over and over again. It's very, very frustrating. I don't know how to tackle it at the root cause. So the next time we look at that supplier as a business, then we can make more informed decisions about our previous experience. However, it scares me that the so many suppliers have that, you know, your pre-accessibility level of experience, you know?
I agree.
What's interesting, being slightly on the other side of it, as one of the suppliers that you're talking about, I mean, we do quite a lot of work with various different charities, and because of that, we are required to do a lot of work for accessibility, and not just our own work, but then also looking a bit at what's already in place from previous suppliers and helping to work with that. And one of the things that I found is that the approach that's taken by not-for-profit is completely different to the approach that's taken by a commercial client. Commercial clients, I find it's me that is mentioning accessibility in the requirement as a project manager or an account handler or, you know, whatever role it is that I'm taking on a particular account, it tends to come from me, whereas with a not-for-profit such as Scope or Christian Aid that I've been working with, the drive is very much in everything that they do, and it's built in at their level as well, and that hugely helps. Because it means they have an appreciation for the, you know, what's involved and how things are going to work. Whereas if I put a line item on an estimate for a commercial client that says that I want to spend X hours building accessible themes and additional work to make videos accessible or other work on the site, I'd probably get told to shave that off the estimate when the time came for it to be signed off.
But I think
it's a bit of a sad state of affairs, really.
I think the thing is, though, John, I think once you actually understand it and understands what's required, it's not necessarily that you will actually spend time doing it. It fundamentally shapes the approach that you take in the design that you provide anyway. So the impact is minimized, if not completely reduced, in terms of costs.
We do everything to AA as a baseline now. So everything that we work on is done at AA, but there are times when the clients have said, that's near enough, can we drop that now and move on to something else, when we're trying to refine things. So it's difficult, but there's definitely, I think if you make it part of your business to do that, I think that you not only get a lot of benefits from it in terms of like the secondary benefits that we'll talk about later on, but also just in terms of building better code that can be picked up by other devs in the organization much quicker, that clients can work with, and just doing things in a better way is very much hand in hand with the accessibility standards, I think.
I think you hit on a good point there, John, as well, though. Accessibility, the chap who talks about accessibility in the meeting, you know, it's almost kind of seen like the party pooper. It's, you know, this groan kind of goes through the room when somebody says, oh, accessibility. And I have to say, I'm kind of guilty of it. I work beside Craig just now, and quite regularly I'll be in a meeting and somebody will suggest something, and then you go, oh, I'm glad Craig's not in the room. And
you do what?
And then also, because of the accessible stuff, you're glad he's not there.
We see about Paul all the time.
But it's true. It is kind of seen as that, you know, the kind of the groan goes through the room because accessibility is mentioned. And, you know, there's this kind of feeling, I think, and it can maybe this slightly kind of the outskirts of the industry that it means that we can't do groovy things. You know, we can't do awesome, beautiful, fantastic, fun things, you know, like a game where somebody's got to go in, find something. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think you've got to get that mindset changed.
It's not necessarily true, but I think it is. It's really hard in the web sphere to do that. I'm working on something for a client just now, which is, you know, lots of jQuery and front-end stuff, lots of complicated interactions, and, you know, accessibility is not a part of the brief at this point. And while I'm building it, I'm kind of thinking, well, how would I make this accessible? And part of that is kind of using good, you know, we're using a REST model for URLs and things. So in theory, we can have a static representation of our resource once we're done. But that's not being built in at the current time. While I was thinking about this show earlier today, I went back and I read an article. It's because this is tying into last week's stuff. I was thinking about how accessibility works on apps and how Apple is actually very good at providing built-in methods for you to access their accessibility toolkit, and that you can make an iOS app very, very accessible with not a lot of work at all, thanks to all the stuff that is built into their toolkits, their development tools. And I'm wondering why we don't quite have anything like that for the web. I recognize part of that is that we have to do so many different things on the web, and we don't know what the content's going to be like before we get there. But you'd think, you know, maybe one of the bigger web frameworks would have made a commitment to that sort of thing.
That's really interesting. I've been writing like a research piece for a while about the state of accessibility in mobile, and I keep meaning to finish it, but I've never got around to it. But what I found in the early stages of that is that Apple do provide an absolute ton of content for developers, exactly as you said. And the difference between that and other platforms like Windows Phone, Android, is actually quite staggering when you go and look at what's available for you in terms of, you know, off the shelf, this is the approach that we're going to take, and this is how you can tie into the core OS in order to, you know, make things easy for people to use. In mobile, it's a real mess everywhere, almost, apart from
there was
from
an article
like
I read yesterday about there's a user group in Canada where visually impaired users help each other to use iOS apps. And one of the stories that came out of that was a blind user taking a photo on her phone just by using the audio hints that the phone gave her, and she got the right photo properly exposed, properly proper subject, without actually seeing the screen at all. Amazing.
Wow, that is amazing.
I think talking about, you know, it's good to talk about the frameworks and the help that is there. We have to remember that we have W3C recommendations and we have WCAG too. The frustrating part is that it's basically unreadable to some people. WCAG 1 was very prescriptive, and it was very, you know, you do ABC and it'll be more or less accessible. Whereas they rewrote WCAG 2, they rewrote it for WCAG 2, and it was a lot, it was the kind of the poor, perceivable, operable, understandable, robust kind of approach they took to describing everything. And I think that it's been, the actual practicalities have been lost in that somewhere. When I'm advising someone on how to make something accessible, I'll point them to WCAG 2 as the latest, most up-to-date resource. But I'll also suggest that they do read WCAG 1 because it's a lot more practical. So there are a lot of good resources out there. It's just, I think they need brought up to date again.
Yeah, for anyone that's not familiar with WCAG, it's the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which is part of the Web Accessibility Initiative's work.
Yeah, that's W3C's website, isn't it? You can get it on there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll put some links in the show notes when we get around to writing show notes.
So, which will be very soon. So there's three levels to WCAG 2, isn't there? So you have A, which is like a baseline standard. Double A, which means you're making a good effort, and then AAA, which is, I guess, is the ideal standard that they want people to comply with.
So where does priority 1, priority 2 come into that then?
That was WCAG 1.
Is that WCAG 1?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of subtleties, I think, between the different levels as well, even down to the point where in order to actually achieve AAA, true AAA, you can't actually judge that on a site that you just deliver to a client until it's had the content populated into it and the content itself has been deemed to be accessible and the way that it's been entered has been accessible. You can't achieve AAA.
That's what I was going to say. AAA is one of those that's is easy for initial setup, but if you've got a large user base that are editing that site, it's nigh on impossible to keep it at that level.
Yeah, it's very aspirational, AAA. It depends on the type of content. Like, you know, if you're concentrating on video, then you are going to want to look at some of the AAA parts. And, you know, I pick and choose some of the AAAs and throw them in with our web standards suite, which is, if you follow the web standards that I've written, it's for the business I'm working in at the moment, you'll achieve AA. But I've thrown quite a few AAAs in there because some of them are quite good link text and in or out of context, sorry. But AAA is very aspirational. It's very hard to roll out, especially at an enterprise level.
Yeah, there's a few bits in there that really do make sense. And then there's other bits where you just think, wow, how am I going to judge myself against this? So, and that's where the help of either someone like yourself working in within an organization or using a third-party accreditation can be really, really useful because they just give you a bit of perspective over what's been done.
Yeah. And you make a good point earlier about talking about building sites for the clients and getting buy-in or making the accessibility case. I was at Future of Web Design a few weeks back and there was a great young lassie called Laura Kalbag presenting, and she was making the same sort of case about responsive web design. And she was saying, you know, if you're struggling to get buy-in for responsive or you're struggling to talk people around for mobile, do what you do with accessibility. Just do it anyway. You know, a lot of the times, if you take these things to the client and they'll see a development process as being time and money, just do it anyway. Just build it into what you're doing. Build it by design and you'll save yourself a lot of trouble down the line.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree with doing that as much as you can. I think responsive, it's a pretty easy... I've always found it a much easier sell, particularly recently. I just show them the Smashing Magazine website and then everything from there on is easy.
Yeah, but, it looks cool. Yeah. It's an obvious one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
everything up to AA is that can be done. AAA is really down to the organisation, especially about maintaining it.
Yeah, it has to be a cultural thing.
there's a lot of good there's a lot of good resources online. You've got the webaim.org, community is excellent, and accessifyforum.com is fantastic again. A lot of good support and information on how to take the rules or the guidance in WCAG 2 and apply it practically. So these are, you should stick those links as well in the show notes too.
Mm-hmm. Will do. I think just mentioned there, it was quite a good point. It's responsive is easy sell because it's tangible. It's something you can see. You can, you know, you can bring up the Boston Globe or you can bring up Smashing Magazine or Starbucks even or something like that and show exactly what the customer is going to get, and you can see them getting all excited about it. But how do you sell accessibility to a customer? I mean, you could use the big stick of, yes, it's the law, but then, you know, there's no case law to kind of prove that anything's actually going to happen. So how do you actually, how do you sell it into a client?
Well, you've got the moral obligation for a start. I mean, that's my driver. That's why I do it. You know, you want as many people. It's inclusive design. It's about not excluding anyone. Mm. I think it'd be pretty hard to sit and talk to someone over the table and for someone to go, oh, yeah, we want to exclude people from being able to see our website. So the moral obligation is the driver, first of all. If you've got a website that has an accessibility policy or corporate social responsibility, that's going to be in there. So it's going to be very hard for them to argue against that. Second of all, you touched on it, Paul, you've got your sort of legal argument, which again, it's such a shame that we don't have some sort of legal precedent in this country at the moment. What we need is a Sydney Olympics. All these cases get settled out of court far too early.
Yeah, I mean, I used to work for a big bank, and part of my job was to do with accessibility, but not on the software side. I was in the property department, and we were making properties wheelchair accessible. So I got to be quite familiar with the Disability Discrimination Act, which is what applies in the UK, and to the best of my knowledge is the only thing that really covers web accessibility. And all it says is that you must make reasonable adjustments, which is not what you'd call strongly worded.
Yeah.
Or very clear either, I don't think.
Yeah.
Because it's completely open to interpretation.
Exactly.
I think that's the issue that we're in with a lot of web-based legislation at the moment, is that it is completely open to the way you want to interpret it, like the cookie thing mess, the quagmire that we're in at the moment of cookies.
Yeah,
what exactly, you know, that's something we'll talk about on another day. But there's just no logic and no reason to it. We seem to inherit these laws from overseas and not really apply them, either apply them directly to the letter or don't adjust them appropriately for here. And I think that's, you know, we're either putting ourselves at a competitive disadvantage or not supporting the people that need it the most in almost all cases.
I read someone on a forum last week actually compare the whole EU cookie legislation to accessibility when accessibility was, quote, all the hype a few years ago. I logged off for fear of being banned or using any profanities on the website. But there is that perception about accessibility that a few years ago it was, oh no, we better sort everything out. But
The cookie law comes from what is fundamentally a positive direction, which is increased privacy for people on the web. It's just the implementation has been horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a lot to say on this, but I'll...
Yeah, we're going to save this one, don't we? Yeah. I've been working on a 10-minute diatribe for another day about that, so...
I think that's going to have to be cut off at like a two-hour podcast, that one, for the amount.
Yeah.
And we've mentioned it in every show.
Yeah,
it's coming, guys. Hang in there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I've been involved in talks with the Information Commissioner's Office as part of a body that I'm chairman of, so I certainly have some stuff to say about that, but more to follow on that subject. But one thing I would just say on this, which is common to the cookie law as well, is, which is a concern, if we were to legislate in this country or in the EU for it, is about the thing about web, obviously, is that it's worldwide, so it's particularly difficult to enforce any legislation when it comes to something like that, because it'd be easy to say, okay, right, well, we'll just offshore the website.
I'll buy some Russian servers, see what you like.
You know, get me wrong, I'm not trying to advocate that's what would happen, but, you know, I'm completely in favour of this and totally understand the importance of it. But it is one of those that is more of a moral obligation rather than something that you should rely on legislation to achieve.
So what are our secondary benefits then? So you've sold in the other points. It's not really happening for you. Where do you go next? So SEO?
Again, yeah, it's something that I'm nervous about mentioning the secondary benefits too much, because if I can't do it on the first couple, then I don't know why I'm working with these people, to be honest. But yeah, I mean, if you break it down to in theory that the search engines want to read well-structured content, structuring your content semantically and a lot better for accessibility should bring you benefits. There are some cons to that as well. Some SEO chaps I've worked with in the past, they like their keywords, they like their spam, and SEO is this sort of black art which is full of characters and underhand tricks sometimes. not all of them, just
no offense to anyone that works in SEO that's listening to the show.
But I've
maybe a little bit of offense. But you can still carry on listening.
I've had some trouble with stuffing of keywords and pages full of words and all that sort of stuff. It's changing now because I mean we all know that SEO, all it is good content and links.
Yeah, and also following the guidelines that are published by the likes of Google and Microsoft and so on and so forth, regular updates and so on and so forth. That there's common guidelines, and pretty much anything else is either tweaking it by buying things or, I'm not going to say, but the kind of things I mean in terms of boosting your rankings and so on and so forth.
I still kind of going back to the idea that just the moral thing and adding the SEO thing, I still think there's going to be some organisations there that just are just not getting it. And I mean, are we ultimately saying, well, in which case, if they don't get it, then they're not worth working with? Or, I mean, is there any other ways that we could kind of push this in?
It is a very tough one. If an organisation is just blatantly not willing to spend put the investment into doing that, then I don't think there's a lot you can really do about it until they actually get it. It is really a tough one.
Yeah. Without legal precedent, you can't.
Yeah. No. No,
because they're not going to care. That's all they're going to listen to.
I
know we talk about servers being elsewhere and all that sort of stuff, but if they're a UK registered company, then the Equality Act shouldn't allow them to discriminate against disabled users. So if the legal precedent was there, it would then make companies think a bit better about which developers they were using and the quality of those developers, and I don't know, some kind of accreditation or certification or this sort of stuff should be getting taught at uni or wherever.
Yeah, but
to
a certain extent, we've already got that accreditation with W3C. It's about raising the profile of that in terms of, a good website and a bad website. I mean, for instance, if for instance, likes of the search engines were to say, okay, well, we'll rank higher if you've got W3C accreditation for, say, AA. That would really make a difference.
It's probably a good point to note as well that when you're looking at validating your HTML, and we're talking about W3C standards, often when we work with suppliers, they might tick, they could give us a valid website and they might be able to argue their way around some points in W3C or WCAG 2, but the site isn't actually usable. We've tested it with screen readers or with various users, and the English, it's not simple English they're using on the site. So there's ways, contractually, there are ways for suppliers to meet W3C guidelines but still be inaccessible, which is another frustration.
And it was apparently 1 in 12 people in the UK have some kind of eye or blind issue. And I know it shouldn't just be about around blind people, but that's a huge stat. 1 in 12 people you could be affected by your accessibility problems. And I suppose that isn't just necessarily around people having to use screen readers and things like that. It also kind of goes down to contrast, which is a big thing that hasn't really been mentioned
up to now. And colorblindness as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, you got colorblind, you got tunnel vision, even if you think about our generation now, we look at screens maybe 12 hours, 18 hours a day. You know, some people, our eyes aren't going to get better when we get older. Well, until technology helps us.
I'm a classic example of when my eyesight's got worse from staring at the screen for so many hours a day.
Exactly. So we have to be building websites in a way that the size can be enlarged to 200%, 400%. And just by making these sites accessible by design, makes them flexible enough to do that. Whereas it really frustrates me, again, there's a lot of frustrations here, but when I look at sites or when I'm working with suppliers, they'll deliver something and then we'll say, well, we want to be able to adjust that to 200% or 400% and it's not quite working by default. And they'll be like, well, it's not a defect, that's an extra cost on the end. To make your site accessible. It's like, guys, you could have done that properly at the start. The nation's eyes aren't getting any better looking at screens, you know, for the next 10, 20 years. So,
Until we get contact lenses that actually have screens projected onto them, I'm waiting for those.
You don't want the Google glasses then?
I wouldn't mind the Google glasses, but I'm looking forward to some kind of contact lenses, because I wear contact lenses just now, and I'm waiting for them. Apparently they're getting developed in, I think it's Germany, a university in Germany, and they actually can project kind of almost like a heads-up display. Obviously it's not project, it's just your eyesight seeing it as a projection, as a heads-up display, and that will allow you to use your computer, and it also kind of monitors your bodily, your heart rate, your blood pressure and things like that. I'm looking forward to them. Then this solves all the problems.
I'll be right there behind you in my flying car. Some.
Paul, are you going to shoot lasers out your eyes at me at work? Yeah.
Does it solve colour blindness?
I don't know. I don't know.
Arguably, that would be a better use of their time to try and do.
I think so.
It's kind of gone down a little bit of a rat hole here, but apparently the real use of it is to actually monitor kind of heart rate and check for signs of heart conditions and things like that. Because apparently the eye, I don't know if it's the fluid in the eye or the eye tissue itself, is the it's kind of window to all of your bodily functions, so your heart, your liver and everything like that, your blood pressure and so on and so forth. So they can actually get the majority of medical information through your eye. So it's designed for a kind of pre-warn against medical attacks and all this kind of stuff. So I'm just thinking of a way that this could be then linked into my phone. It can be checking me, it can be checking my cholesterol and everything like that. And then it can also be projecting a heads-up display of Google for pub quizzes. Best of both worlds.
So we've talked a bit about eyes. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to segue. So we've talked quite a lot about eyes so far, but what about other disabilities? How are they affected from what we do? Obviously, the people with motor problems need to be able to tab through a page, I guess, rather than and use keyboard navigation. Yeah, and there's various tools either baked into the OS, like in macOS, with VoiceOver, or there's tools for Windows such as JAWS that people can use to have sites read aloud to them. How do you go about testing for these environments?
Well, you got open source. NVDA is a good open source screen reader. It works on Windows. I'm not sure about Mac. JAWS you can demo for free, although I'd caveat by saying I think that you're not supposed to use it for testing.
No, you're supposed to buy it, and it's quite expensive as well.
It's a couple of grand, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it is awesome. If anyone's actually ever seen it in practice, I have. It is amazing. I've seen some fantastic demos of it.
Yeah.
JAWS, it's got the best voices as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the most eye-opening things, if you pardon the pun, of me seeing sorry, that wasn't intentional. we had Jaws at a job a few years ago, five years ago, and we had it on all of our machines, and it was intended for test purposes. You know, the licenses were all fully paid and whatnot. And we were playing with it, and always found it a little bit clunky, and ultimately I got to what I wanted it to do. I checked if the links were okay and whatnot. But then I went along to a demonstration of it, and they actually had a gentleman, he was a developer, and he was completely 100% blind, and it was just incredible seeing him use this software, because it wasn't even close to how I perceived them using it, because I was trying to use it as a fully 100% sight person, and I was kind of using it as if I could actually see the screen, but it was just incredible. If ever you get the opportunity for it to see see Jaws being demoed properly and being used properly, it's just an eye-opening experience, and I think it really kind of reinforces the need for not just sit there and test with Jaws software on your machine. You have to actually go to a specialist facility for to have these kind of things tested thoroughly.
Of course, yeah, it's incredible to see it in action. If anyone does want to test, I'd recommend downloading some sort of cheat sheet that tells you all the quick commands that may often get used. When you do see it in action, the voice is often 3-4 times the speed of normal speaking. Again, you'll see why it's important to use semantic HTML, because often users will navigate through heading levels and jump to landmark areas of the page, such as forms or search areas, what have you.
Paul, I know you sometimes work with a local usability lab or two. Do they have any of this software available? Is it something that you can kind of come in off the street as a client and say, can you run this through your test suite?
Yeah, yes, they do. The two in Edinburgh, which are they're fantastic facilities, and they have all that kind of thing, and they actually have people who know how to use Jaws and other such softwares back to front. They're superb. Definitely way to go. The company actually I got demoed from was actually down in London, but the name escapes me just now. But they'd come up to Edinburgh to do a demonstration a few years back. But it's all available. Yep.
Yeah, I've done quite a bit. I've done some work with in this area with, I don't know if anyone's heard of the Shaw Trust, who actually they actually do testing of websites for this sort of, make sure that that testing the various level of accessibility, particularly in the public sector. And it was them that actually really got me into seeing how good Jaws really is.
Yeah, they're good guys. They test everything that we make for Scope, so they're really good to work with. And they don't just. I think the most important thing is, if you're going to build a relationship with a testing house, is not to just get like one word bullet point replies that come back and say this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. What we've really been really keen to do is to build a real dialogue with them, so that if there is any problems that we're having, we learn, and then for next time. So progressively, each time we've had stuff tested for them, the report we get back is shorter and shorter and shorter, because we're learning as an organization rather than just individual devs looking at it. So we all look at it together, and it's really helped, and their approach has really suited us well.
Yeah, but it's also not just them saying where it doesn't work. It's also making recommendations of how you can actually improve it, as you say.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's been something that's been really core for our experience. We approached it with a good understanding of what accessibility is, but I think working with an external provider has really allowed us to just push it on to the next level. And it's certainly something I would advocate and suggest to anyone out there that's looking to formalize their offering a little more.
I think there's definitely, you all make a good point, there's definitely no substitute for real user testing. There are some good tools to use, Total Validator and the Wave Toolbar, which will spit out reports and point out in your markup where things are wrong, but there's no replacement for getting, an elderly user in, or someone that's blind, or, whatever.
Yeah, I think so. I think ultimately with everything, and it's something that I want to talk about in a future episode, is testing. Everything that has to be tested before it ever hits a live production environment. So I think it's a nice point here to mention our sponsor this week, who are UK2. The UK2.net have sponsored the British Tech Network for over 3 years now. They're superb, and they've given us a pile of voucher codes for to give out here. So I'm just going to run through these very, very quickly. I believe, actually, Sarah, do you know if these are on the website yet?
In what way?
As in, can you find these on the website? sorry, I've just put you on the spot there a little bit.
I mean, yeah, you did a bit. No, I mean, at the moment, the on the left-hand side of the website, down the left-hand side, there's the link to the UK2 site, which we would encourage you to use because we get credit for doing that. We should actually get the all the individual codes on the website, so I'll bear that in mind.
Oh, yeah, sorry, that was a little bit of a hospital pass there. I apologise, Sarah. Right, okay.
It was really, sounded really smooth, guys. It was good.
yeah, you go to the link on the left-hand side of the British Tech Network site. You go onto UK2 and you fill your shopping basket with all the goodness that they have in there. And when you come to the end, once you've got everything you need, you pop in some of these voucher codes and they do some great things to your shopping basket. So British Tech DNS gives you free DNS for 2 years, if you've put DNS in your shopping basket, of course. British Tech Domains gets you 20% off your domain name. British Tech VPN gives you 50% off your first month's VPN charges. British Tech Server gives you £50 off any gigabit server that's on any contract length. Now, that one's only online. I believe the other ones you can use on the phone, but that one you can only do online. And British Tech VPS gives you your first month's free with a VPS server. So if you head over to British Tech Network, click on UK2 and buy some of their services. They're fantastic. They've supported the network for many years, and we like to support them. So fire on over there and fill your boots. Have we kind of covered everything we're wanting to do on accessibility? Is there anything else that anybody wants to kind of, any burning issues that we've not covered yet on accessibility? I will take dead silence as well, a rule.
It's a complicated subject. I think we could talk about it out, but I think what we were looking to do today was try and give a bit of a primer and instruct people on the reasons why they should care, and I think we've covered that. So,
yeah. And I would say, you know, if you want to read more, there's tons of resources out there, and a lot of them will be in the show notes. But, you know, you can't read too much about the stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's possibly also one of these subjects you might come back to in a couple of months or something like that, because if you've got any questions or anything like that on this subject, there's tons and tons of stuff. I mean, as John just said there quite rightly, and Ian, we've only just scratched the surface of this. So any questions or anything like this, and if we get enough questions, and we might end up touching back on this subject in a few months' time or something. So all good. On that topic, what are we talking about next time, John?
We have some cool things that we want to talk about first, do we not?
Okay, yes. Smooth as ice tonight.
Yeah, before we get onto anything else, we want to talk about our cool things, which is what I'd prepared for. So who does anyone want to go first? Shall I go first?
We go first because we prepared. We just kind of threw Craig and Ian at the deep end to tell them their picks. So Ian, John, do you want to go first? And then I'll do mine.
Yes. So mine is topical based on our conversation we have today. It's actually some dead tree that I have in my hand. It's a book, but you can get it as an ebook. And it's called Universal Design for Web Applications. And it's by Wendy Chisholm and Matt May, published by O'Reilly, who make the excellent books with animals on the front that you will have seen in any developer collection. And the book is a really, really useful introduction to anyone that wants to get involved with building websites that work for everyone. So it's not just about markup, it's about actually the whole approach of building sites that can be used by people with disabilities and people without disabilities, and even, you know, goes into really good amount of detail. It's not particularly thick, but it tells you all the stuff that you need to know to get started, and will give you some really good places to look up from there. So you can find that at O'Reilly.com. It's a few years old now, and I'm hoping they'll do a new one, but it's still really useful.
It's £22.94 currently on Amazon, and the Kindle edition £16.82 at the moment.
If you want the ebook version, get it direct from O'Reilly because it'll be lots cheaper.
Oh, right. Okay. Cool. Great. My pick this week it's actually an iOS app, but it goes hand in hand with a desktop application. Coda 2 came out for the Mac just in the last couple of weeks, and I've always been a BB Edit user, but I have to admit I've moved over to Coda, and I really, really enjoy it, mainly because with BB Edit, I used to have to use I use CyberDuck as well as the FTP client, and then you had both of them open and you were kind of switching between the two, and it was fine, but I just find all the autocompletes and everything like that in Coda much better. It's got Transit embedded. It's just got a really, really nice interface. And it just looks really, really pretty. BB Edit just looks like a text editor, which a lot of people like, and I'm not downing or anything like that. But I just really, really like Coda. But what my actual pick is an application for the iPad, and it only works on the iPad. It's not an iPhone version. And it's called Diet Coda. It's $13.99 in the iTunes, as in the App Store. And very, very similar, but it basically allows you to edit your sites on the move. So if you've got like 3G or Wi-Fi or something like that, it actually has a really nice keyboard interface. It's got some extra shortcuts at the top of the keyboard, and it's just lovely. And another really, really nice little thing that it does is if you've got Coda or running on your Mac, it's got a little button at the bottom that allows you to preview in Diet Coda, which basically means it just sends it to your iPad. And allows you to preview it in portrait and landscape on the iPad, so it's quite nice for kind of testing responsive and whatnot. So yeah, really like it. Diet Coda for the iPad, $13.99 in the iTunes store. Sarah, do you have a pick for us?
I do indeed, and it's very much based around accessibility. I know we mentioned JAWS, however, one of the tools that I really like for websites and is another tool called Browse Aloud. I don't know if anyone here has actually heard of it.
Yes, yeah.
But the way that the reason I particularly like this is that you can actually see, the way it works is you actually the site owner actually pay a fee. So it's very much for a commercial organization, but you pay a fee, and then anyone who wants to use that site and have the site read to them or whatever can just download the a small piece of software from their website and actually use it. So it means that absolutely anybody can use it. It's not, you're not relying on the user to actually buy the software to actually maximize the ability to be able to get the best out of your website. And that's browsealoud.com.
Superb. And Ian, do you have a pick for us?
Yes, it's topical as well, as it's been mentioned a couple of times, but I'm going to pick Wave, which is an online accessibility tool for evaluating how good your site is. As we said before, it's no substitute for user testing, but it will point out parts of your markup that you might want to change or improve. It's at wave.webaim.org, and you can also get it as a toolbar for Firefox, so you can just do it on any page anytime you like.
Superb. Superb. Is that free?
It is, yes.
Yeah, free toolbar. And Craig, do you have a pick for us?
Yes, mine's topical as well. Total Validator tool. You can download it and run it on your desktop, and it's got a Firefox plugin as well. You run this tool. It's very similar to Wave. It'll match up your markup against the whatever criteria you specify. So it could be Section 508 or WCAG 2 or WCAG 1, the various sort of recommendations for accessibility. Again, that one's free. I think there's a free version and a premium version, which allows for different types of reporting.
Grant, good. Like free. Now, the bit that I tried to do before, John rightly put the brakes on.
Sorry.
Tell us. We've got to know.
What are we going to do
secret.
In the next show?
So, on the next show, we'll be covering all things HTML5 and CSS3, where to start, what can be achieved, what are the drawbacks, and lots of other stuff as well, no doubt. If you have any questions, queries, or points for discussion, please do send it in, and we'll include it on the next show, which we'll be recording in 2 weeks' time. You can get us at britishtechnews@gmail.com.
Yes. Also, if you can fire the questions at any one of us on Twitter. If you want to get a hold of me on Twitter, I'm Paul Wheatley. That's Paul, W-H-E-A-T-L-E-Y.
And you can get me, John, and I am Hume Deeney, which is H-U-M-E-D-I-N-I. Or you can get me at johnhume.co.uk.
And you can get me on the Twitters at SarahJaneUK.
Ian, where can we get a hold of you, mate?
I am also on the Twitters at ManiacYak, which is M-A-N-I-A-C-Y-A-K.
And Craig, where can we get you?
You can get me on Twitter as well. I'm Craig McPheat, CREIGMCPHEAT. You can also get me at the craigmcpheat.co.uk.
Does that still say, just in Times New Roman, in the top left-hand corner, I'm not taking on any work just now?
I installed, when does this show go out? I installed WordPress last night. It was accessible though, Paul.
Superb. But most importantly, if you've liked what you heard, or even if you haven't, please fire on over and give us a 5-star review. We don't really mind if you've liked it or not, just give us 5 stars. In iTunes, that really helps us. We really appreciate it.
I'm not sure you understand what a review is.
I got told off on Twitter this week, actually, for asking for 5-star reviews. Apparently, it's frowned upon by Apple, and they do monitor these things. So we should only do it in audio form. Don't ask for them in tweet form. But do it anyway, though.
10% of you, please give us a 4-star review. Thank you.
Yeah, 5% give a 4-star review. 95% give a 5-star review and say how much you love all of the Scottish accents as well, please, if you can.
Yes, do that.
And the English ones.
Yeah, actually,
there's a lone voice from the corner.
I'm not Scottish.
I should have said before, actually, you could get me on 2 of my other shows, which is the iOS show, which Ian also guests on, and the Gamer show. And actually, we've got a competition at the moment. Sorry.
See, as we're plugging shows, I'm also on the F1 and the Big Show.
There you go. Yes.
You should definitely listen to all of the shows and watch them with your eyes, if you possibly can, every week.
Indeed.
But if you don't have eyes, they're accessible with your ears.
Yes, they're perfectly accessible with your ears too.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, all the shows on the British Tech Network, all the goodness over there. And I think that's us. Is that us, John? We've done everything?
That's us. Done. See you in 2 weeks, guys.
Superb. Thanks very much, folks.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Bye.